Chapter 6.
The best way to begin is to lay a tunic or a coat across his back,
Hetar said in his quiet voice. The tall Algar wore his usual black leather, and he stood with Erend in the pasture, lying to the west of Poledra's cottage.
Be sure that it is something that has your scent on it. You want him to get used to your smell and the idea that it's all right if something that smells like you is on his back.
He already knows what I smell like, doesn't he?
Erend asked.
This is just a little different,
Hetar told him.
You have to go at these things slowly. You don't want to frighten him. If he is frightened, he will try to throw you off of his back.
We're friends,
Erend tried to explain.
He knows I won't do anything to hurt him. So why should he try to do something to hurt me?
Hetar shook his head and looked out over the rolling grassland.
Just do it the way I explained, Erend. Believe me, I know what I am talking about.
If you really want me to, but I think it's an awful waste of time.
Trust me.
Erend obediently laid one of his old tunics across the horse's back several times while the horse looked at him curiously, quite obviously wondering what he was doing. Erend wished that he could make Hetar understand. They had already wasted a good part of the morning on the hawk-faced Algar warrior's cautious approach to horse training. If they had just got right on with it, Erend knew that he and the horse could be galloping together across the free open expanse of the hills and the valleys stretched out before them.
Is that enough?
Erend asked, after he had put the tunic on the horse's back several times.
Can I get on him now?
Hetar sighed.
It looks as if you are going to have to learn the hard way. Go ahead, climb on, if you want. Try to find a soft place to land when he throws you off, though.
He wouldn't do that,
Erend replied confidently. He put his hand on the chestnut's neck and gently led him over to where a white boulder stuck up out of the turf.
Don't you think you ought to bridle him first?
Hetar asked him.
At least that gives you something to hang on to.
I don't think so. I don't believe he'd like that bridle.
It's up to you,
Hetar said.
Do it any way you like. Just try not to break anything when you fall.
Oh, I don't think I'll fall.
Tell me, do you know what the word wager means?
Erend laughed and climbed up on the boulder.
Well, here we go.
He threw his leg over the horse's back. The colt flinched slightly and stood trembling.
It's all right,
Erend assured him in a calm voice. The horse turned and looked at him with soft astonishment in his large liquid eyes.
You had better hang on,
Hetar warned. But his eyes had an oddly puzzled look, and his voice was not quite as certain as the words.
He's fine.
Erend flexed his legs, not actually even bringing his heels in contact with the chestnut's flanks. The horse took a tentative step forward, then looked back inquiringly.
That's the idea,
Erend encouraged him. The horse took several more steps, then stopped to look back over his shoulder again.
Good,
Erend said, patting his neck.
Very, very good.
The horse pranced about enthusiastically.
Watch out,
Hetar said sharply. Erend leaned forward and pointed toward a grassy knoll several hundred yards off to the southwest.
Let's go up there,
he said into the sharply upstanding ear. The horse gave a sort of delighted shudder, bunched himself, and ran for the hilltop as hard as he could. When moments later they crested the knoll, he slowed and pranced about proudly.
All right, Erend said, laughing with sheer delight. Now why don't we go to that tree way over there on that other hillside?
It was unnatural,
Hetar said moodily that evening, as they all sat at the table in Poledra's cottage, bathed in golden firelight.
Well, they seem to be doing all right,
Durnik said mildly.
But he is doing everything wrong,
Hetar protested.
That horse should have gone absolutely wild when Erend just got on him like that, without any warning at all. And you don't tell a horse where you want him to go. You have to steer him. That's what the reins are for.
Erend is an unusual boy, Belgarath told him. And the horse is an unusual horse. As long as they get along and understand each other, what difference does it make?
It is unnatural,
Hetar said again with a baffled look.
I kept waiting for the horse to panic, but his mind stayed absolutely calm. I know what a horse is thinking, and about the only thing that colt was feeling when Erend got on his back was curiosity. Curiosity! He did not do or think anything the way he should.
He shook his head darkly, and his long black scalp lock swung back and forth as if in emphasis.
It is unnatural, he growled,
as if that were the only word he could think of to sum up the situation.
I think you have already said that several times, Hetar, Polgara told him. Why don't we just drop the subject, since it seems to bother you so much? And you can tell me about Adara's baby instead.
An expression of fatuous pleasure came over Hetar's fierce hawk-like face.
He's a boy, he said with the overwhelming pride of a new father.
We gathered that, Polgara said calmly. How big was he when he was born?
Oh, Hetar looked perplexed. About so big, I'd say.
He held his hands half a yard apart.
No one took the trouble to measure him.
They might have done that, I suppose. My mother and the other ladies were doing all sorts of things right after he came.
And would you care to estimate his weight?
Probably about as much as a full-grown hare, I suppose. A fairly good-sized one. Or perhaps the weight of one of those red Sindarian cheeses.
I see. Perhaps a foot and a half long and 8 or 9 pounds. Is that what you are trying to say?
Her look was steady.
About that, I suppose.
Why didn't you say so, then?
She demanded in exasperation. He looked at her, startled.
Is it really that important?
Yes, Hetar, it really is that important. Women like to know these things.
I'll have to remember that. About all I was really interested in was whether he had the usual number of arms, legs, ears, nose, things like that. That and making sure that his very first food was mare's milk, of course.
Of course.
It's very important, Polgara. Every Algar's first drink is mare's milk.
That makes him part horse, I suppose?
He blinked.
No, of course not. But it establishes a sort of bond.
Did you milk the mare for him, or did you make him crawl out and find one for himself?
You are taking all of this very oddly, Polgara.
Blame it on my age, she said in a dangerous voice.
He caught the tone almost immediately.
No, I don't think I'd want to do that.
Wise decision, Durnick murmured. You said that you were going up to the mountains of Ulgerland.
Hetar nodded.
You remember the Hrulgen?
The flesh-eating horses?
I have sort of an idea I want to try out. A full-grown Hrulga cannot be tamed, of course. But maybe if I can capture some of their colts.
That's very dangerous, Hetar,
Belgarath warned.
The whole herd will defend the young.
There are some ways to separate the colts from the rest of the herd.
Polgara looked at him disapprovingly.
Even if you succeed, what do you plan to do with the beasts?
Tame them,
Hetar replied simply.
They cannot be tamed.
Nobody has ever tried it. And even if I cannot tame them, perhaps I can breed them with ordinary horses.
Durnick looked puzzled.
Why would you want horses with fangs and claws?
Hetar looked thoughtfully into the fire.
They are faster and stronger than ordinary horses. They can jump much farther and...
His voice drifted off into silence.
And because you can't stand the idea of anything that looks like a horse, that you can't ride,
Belgarath finished for him.
That might be part of it, Hetar admitted. They would give a man a tremendous advantage in a battle, though.
Hetar, Durnick said. Most important thing in Algeria is the cattle, right?
Yes.
You really want to start raising a breed of horses that would probably look at a cow as something to eat?
Hettar frowned and scratched at his chin.
I had not thought about that, he admitted.
Now that he had the horse, Eren's range increased enormously. The young stallion's stamina was virtually inexhaustible, and he could run for most of the day without tiring. Because Erend was still only a boy, his weight was not enough to burden the enthusiastic animal, and they ran freely over the rolling grass-covered hills of southern Algeria and down into the tree-dotted expanse of the Vale of Aldur. The boy rose early each morning and ate his breakfast impatiently. Knowing that the chestnut stallion was waiting just outside the cottage, and that, as soon as breakfast was over, the two of them could gallop out through the dew-drenched grass, glistening green and lush in the slanting golden rays of the morning sun, and pound up the long slopes of the hills, lying before them with the cool, sweet morning air rushing past them. Polgara, who seemed to know instinctively why they both had this need to run, said nothing as Erend wolfed down his food, sitting on the very edge of his chair, so that at the very instant his plate was clean he could bolt for the door and the day which lay before him. Her eyes were gentle as she watched him, and the smile she gave him when he asked to be excused was an understanding one. On a dewy, sun-filled morning in late summer, when the tall grass was golden and heavy with ripe seeds, Erend came out of the door of the cottage and touched the bowed neck of his waiting friend with a gentle, caressing hand. The horse quivered with pleasure and took a few prancing steps, eager to be off. Erend laughed, took a handful of the stallion's mane, swung his leg and flowed up onto the strong, glossy back in a single fluid move. The horse was running almost before the boy was in place. They galloped up the long hill, paused to look out over the sun-touched grassland lying open before them, then circled the small valley, where the thatched stone cottage lay, and headed south, down into the vale. This day's ride was not, as so many of the others had been, a random excursion with no particular goal or purpose. For several days now, Erend had felt the presence of a strange, subtle awareness emanating from the vale that seemed to be calling to him, and as he had emerged from the cottage door, he had suddenly resolved to find out exactly what it was that seemed to summon him so quietly. As they moved down into the quiet vale, past placidly gazing deer and curious rabbits, Erend could feel that awareness growing stronger. It was a peculiar kind of consciousness, dominated more than anything by an incredible patience, an ability, it seemed, to wait for eons for a response to these occasional quiet calls. As they crested a tall, rounded hill a few leagues to the west of Belgarath's tower, a brief shadow flickered across the bending grass. Erend glanced up and saw a blue-banded hawk circling on motionless wings on a rising column of sun-warmed air. Even as the boy watched, the hawk tilted, side-slipped, then spiraled down in long, graceful circles. When it was no more than inches above the golden tassels of the ripe grass, it flared its wings, thrust down with its taloned feet, and seemed somehow to shimmer in the morning sun. When the momentary shimmer faded, the hawk was gone, and the hunchbacked Beldon stood waist-deep in the tall grass, with one eyebrow cocked curiously.
"What are you doing all the way down here, boy?"
he asked, without any kind of preamble.
"Good morning, Beldon,"
Erend said calmly, leaning back to let the horse know that he wanted to stop for a few minutes.
"Does Paul know how far from home you've been going?"
the ugly man demanded, ignoring Erend's gesture toward politeness.
"Probably not entirely," Erend admitted. "She knows that I'm out riding, but she might not know how much ground we can cover."
"I've got better things to do than spend every day watching over you, you know," the irascible old man growled.
"You don't have to do that."
"Yes, as a matter of fact, I do. It's my month for it."
Erend looked at him puzzled.
"Didn't you know that one of us watches over you every time you leave the cottage?"
"Why would you want to do that?"
"You do remember Zadar, don't you?"
Erend sighed sadly.
"Yes."
"Oh, don't waste your sympathy on him. He got exactly what he deserved."
Nobody deserves that.
Belden gave a snort of ugly laughter.
He's lucky that it was Belgarath who caught up with him. If it had been me, I'd have done a lot more than just seal him up inside solid rock. But that's beside the point. You remember why Zadar found you and took you with him?
To steal the Orb of Aldur.
Right. So far as we know, you are the only person besides Belgarion who can touch the orb and keep on living. Other people know that, too. So you might as well get used to the idea of being watched. We are not going to let you wander around alone where somebody might get his hands on you. Now, you didn't answer my question.
Which question?
What are you doing all the way down in this part of the Vale?
There's something I need to see.
What's that?
I don't know. It's up ahead somewhere. What is it that's off in that direction?
There's nothing out there but the tree.
Well, that must be it, then. It wants to see me.
See?
Maybe that's the wrong word.
Belden scowled at him.
Are you sure it's the tree?
No, not really. All I know is that something in that direction has been, I want to say, inviting me to come by. Would that be the proper word?
It's talking to you, not me. Pick any word you like. All right, let's go then.
Would you like to ride? Horse can carry us both.
Haven't you given him a name yet?
Horse is good enough. He doesn't seem to feel that he needs one. Would you like to ride?
Why would I want to ride when I can fly?
Erend felt a sudden curiosity.
What's it like? He asked. Flying, I mean.
Belden's eyes suddenly changed to become distant and almost soft.
Oh, you couldn't even begin to imagine. Well, just keep your eyes on me. When I get over the tree, I'll circle to show you where it is.
He stooped in the tall grass, curved out his arms, and gave a strong leap. As he rose into the air, he shimmered into feathers and swooped away. The tree stood in a solitary immensity in the middle of a broad meadow, its trunk larger than a house, its widespread branches shading entire acres, and its crown rising hundreds of feet into the air. It was incredibly ancient. Its roots reached down almost into the very heart of the world, and its branches touched the sky. It stood alone and silent, as if forming a link between earth and sky, a link whose purpose was beyond the understanding of man. As Erend rode up to the vast shaded area beneath the tree's shelter, Belden swooped in, hovered, and dropped, almost seeming to stumble into his natural form.
All right, there it is. Now what?
I'm not sure.
Erend slid down off of the horse's back and walked across the soft, springy turf toward the immense trunk. The sense of the tree's awareness was very strong now, and Erend approached it curiously, still unable to determine exactly what it wanted with him. Then he put out his hand and touched the rough bark. In the instant that he touched it, he understood. He quite suddenly knew the whole of the tree's existence. He found that he could look back over a million, million mornings to the time when the world had just emerged out of the elemental chaos from which the gods had formed it. All at once, he knew of the incredible length of time that the earth had rolled in silence, awaiting the coming of man. He saw the endless turning of the seasons and felt the footsteps of the gods upon the earth. And, even as the tree knew, Erend came to know the fallacy which lay behind man's conception of the nature of time. Man needed to compartmentalize time, to break it into manageable pieces, aeons, centuries, years, and hours. This eternal tree, however, understood that time was all one piece, that it was not merely an endless repetition of the same events, but rather that it moved from its beginning toward a final goal. All of that convenient segmenting which men used to make time more manageable had no real meaning. It was to tell him this simple truth that the tree had summoned him here. As he grasped that fact, the tree acknowledged him in friendship and affection. Slowly, Erend let his fingertips slide from the bark Then he turned and walked back to where Belden stood.
"That's it?"
the hunchback sorcerer asked.
"That's all it wanted?"
"Yes, that's all. We can go back now."
Belden gave him a penetrating look.
"What did it say?"
"It's not the kind of thing you can put into words."
"Try."
"Well, it was sort of saying that we pay too much attention to years."
"Oh, that's enormously helpful, Erend."
Erend struggled with it, trying to formulate words that would express what he had just learned.
"Things happen in their own time," he said finally. "It doesn't make any difference how many or few of what we call years come between them."
"What things are we talking about?"
"The important ones. Do you really have to follow me all the way home?"
"I need to keep an eye on you. That's about all. Are you going back now?"
"Yes."
"I'll be up there."
Belden made a gesture toward the arching blue dome of the sky. He shuddered into the form of a hawk and drove himself into the air with strong thrusts of his wings. Erend pulled himself up onto the chestnut stallion's back. His pensive mood was somehow communicated to the animal. Instead of a gallop, the horse turned and walked north, back toward the cottage nestling in its valley. The boy considered the message of the eternal tree as he rode slowly through the golden, sun-drenched grass, and, lost in thought, he paid little attention to his surroundings. It was thus that he was not actually aware of the robed and hooded figure standing beneath a broad-spread pine until he was almost on top of it. It was the horse that warned him with a startled snort as the figure made a slight move.
"Unsaw, thou art the one,"
it snarled in a voice which seemed scarcely human. Erend calmed the horse with a reassuring hand on its quivering neck and looked at the dark figure before him. He could feel the waves of hatred emanating from that shadowy form. And he knew that of all the things he had ever encountered, this was the thing he should most fear. Yet surprising even himself, he remained calm and unafraid. The shape laughed an ugly, dusty kind of sound.
"Thou art a fool, boy. Fear me, for the day will come when I shall surely destroy thee."
"Not surely," Erend replied calmly.
He peered closely at the shadow-shrouded form and saw at once that, like the figure of Ceratus he had met on the snowy hilltop, this seemingly substantial shape was not really here, but somewhere else, sending its malevolent hatred across the empty miles.
"Besides, I'm old enough now not to be afraid of shadows."
"We will meet in the flesh, boy," the shadow snarled. "And in that meeting, shalt thou die?"
"That hasn't been decided yet, has it?" Erend said. "That's why we have to meet, to decide which of us will stay and which must go."
The dark-robed shape drew in its breath with a sharp hiss.
"Enjoy thy youth, boy, for it is all the life thou shalt have. I will prevail."
Then the dark shape vanished. Erend drew in a deep breath and glanced skyward at the circling Belden. He realized that not even the hawk's sharp eyes could have penetrated the spreading tree limbs to where that strange, cowled figure had stood. Belden could not know of the meeting. Erend nudged the stallion's flanks, and they moved away from the solitary tree at a flowing canter, riding in the golden sunlight toward home. Chapter 7. The years that followed were quiet years at the cottage. Belgarath and Belden were often away for long periods of time, and when they returned, travel-stained and weary, their faces usually wore the frustrated look of men who have not found what they are looking for. Although Durnick was often on the stream bank, bending all of his attention to the problem of convincing some wary trout that a thumbnail-sized bit of polished metal with a few strands of red yarn trailing behind it in the current was not merely edible, but irresistibly delicious,
He nonetheless maintained the cottage and its immediate surroundings in that scrupulously tidy condition which announced louder than words that the proprietor of any given farmstead was a Sindar. Although rail fences by their very nature zigzagged and tended to meander with the lay of the ground, Durnick firmly insisted that his fence lines be absolutely straight. He was quite obviously constitutionally incapable of going around any obstacle. Thus, if a large rock happened to intrude itself in the path of one of his fences, he immediately stopped being a fence builder and became an excavator. Polgara immersed herself in domesticity. The interior of her cottage was immaculate. Her doorstep was not merely swept, but frequently scrubbed. The rows of beans, turnips, and cabbages in her garden were as straight as any of Durnick's fences, and weeds were absolutely forbidden. Her expression, as she toiled at these seemingly endless tasks, was one of dreamy contentment, and she hummed or sang very old songs as she worked. The boy Erand, however, tended on occasion toward vagrancy. This was not to say that he was indolent, but many of the chores around a rural farmstead were tedious, involving repeating the same series of actions over and over again. Stacking firewood was not one of Erand's favorite pastimes. Weeding the garden seemed somehow futile since the weeds grew back overnight. Drying the dishes seemed an act of utter folly since, left alone, the dishes would dry themselves without any assistance whatsoever. He made some effort to sway Polgara to his point of view in this particular matter. She listened gravely to his impeccable logic, nodding her agreement as he demonstrated with all the eloquence at his command that the dishes did not really need to be dried. And when he had finished, summing up all his arguments with a dazzling display of sheer brilliance, she smiled and said, "Yes, dear," and implacably handed him the dish towel. Erend was hardly overburdened with unremitting toil, however. In point of fact, not a day went by when he did not spend several hours on the back of the chestnut stallion roaming the grasslands surrounding the cottage as freely as the wind. Beyond the timeless, golden doze of the vale, the world moved on. Although the cottage was remote, visitors were not uncommon. Hetar, of course, rode by often, and sometimes he was accompanied by Adara, his tall, lovely wife and their infant son. Like her husband, Adara was an Algar to her fingertips, as much at home in the saddle as she was on her feet. Erend was very fond of her. Though her face always seemed serious, even grave, there lurked just beneath that calm exterior an ironic, penetrating wit that absolutely delighted him. It was more than that, however. The tall, dark-haired girl with her flawless features and alabaster skin carried about her a light, delicate fragrance that always seemed to tug at the outer edges of his consciousness. There was something elusive yet strangely compelling about that scent. Once, when Polgara was playing with the baby, Adara rode with Erend to the top of a nearby hill, and there she told him about the perfume she wore and where it originated.
"You did know that Geryon is my cousin?" she asked him. "Yes. We had ridden out from the stronghold once. It was in the winter when everything was locked in frost. The grass was brown and lifeless, and all of the leaves had fallen from the bushes. I asked him about sorcery, what it was and what he could do with it. I didn't really believe in sorcery. I wanted to, but I just could not bring myself to believe it. He took up a twig and wrapped some dry grass around it. Then he turned it into a flower right in front of my eyes."
Erend nodded.
"Yes, that's the kind of thing Geryon would do. Did it help you to believe?"
She smiled.
"Not right away. At least not altogether. There was something else I wanted him to do, but he said he couldn't." "What was that?"
She blushed rosily and then laughed.
"It still embarrasses me. I wanted him to use his power to make Hetar love me." "But he didn't have to do that," Erend said. "Hetar loved you already, didn't he?" "Well, he needed a little help to make him realize it. but I was feeling very sorry for myself that day. When we rode back to the stronghold, I forgot the flower and left it behind, on the sheltered side of a hill. A year or so later, the whole hillside was covered with low bushes and these beautiful little lavender flowers. Tenedra calls the flower Adara's Rose, and Eriana thought it might have some medicinal value, even though we have never been able to find anything that it cures. I like the fragrance of the flower, and it eases mine in a sort of special way. So I sprinkle petals in the chests where I keep my clothes.
She laughed a wicked sort of little laugh.
It makes Hetar very affectionate. I don't think that's entirely caused by the flower, Eren said. Perhaps. But I am not going to take any chances with that. If the scent gives me an advantage, I'm certainly going to use it. That makes sense, I suppose. Oh, Eren, she laughed. You are an absolutely delightful little boy.
The visits of Hetar and Adara were not entirely social in nature. Hetar's father was King Kohag, chief of the clan chiefs of Algeria, and Kohag, the nearest of the Elorn monarchs, felt that it was his responsibility to keep Polgara advised of the events which were taking place in the world beyond the boundaries of the Vale. From time to time he sent reports of the progress of the bloody endless war in southern Solmurgos, where Kalzakath, emperor of Meloria, continued his implacable march across the plains of Hecha and into the great southern forest in Gorut. The kings of the west were at a loss to explain Zakath's seemingly unreasoning hatred of his Murgo cousins. There were rumors of a personal affront at some point in the past, but that had involved Tar Urgas, and Tar Urgas had died at the Battle of Tal Mordu. Zakath's enmity for the Murgos, however, had not died with the madman who ruled them, and he now led his Melorians in a savage campaign evidently designed to exterminate all of Murgodom, and to erase from human memory all traces of the fact that the Murgos had ever existed. In Tolnedra, Emperor Ranborun XXIII, the father of Queen Tenedra of Riva, was in failing health, and because he had no son to succeed him on the imperial throne at Tolhanath, the great families of the empire were engaged in a vicious struggle over the succession. Enormous bribes changed hands, and assassins crept through the streets of Tolhanath by night with sharpened daggers and vials of those deadly poisons purchased in secret from the snake people of Nyestia. The wily Ranborun, however, much to the chagrin and outrage of the Honoths, the Vordus, and the Horbites, had appointed General Varana, the Duke of Anadil, as his regent. And Varana, whose control of the legions was nearly absolute, took firm steps to curb the excesses of the great houses in their scramble for the throne. The internecine wars of the Angoraks and the only slightly less savage struggles of the Grand Dukes of the Tolnedran Empire, however, were of only passing interest to the Elorn kings. The monarchs of the north were far more concerned with the troublesome resurgences of the bear cult and with the sad but undeniable fact that King Rhodar of Drasnia was quite obviously declining rapidly. Rhodar, despite his vast bulk, had demonstrated an astonishing military genius during the campaign which had culminated in the Battle of Tul Mardu. But Kohag sadly reported that the corpulent Drasnian monarch had grown forgetful and in some ways even childish in the past few years. Because of his huge weight, he could no longer stand unaided, and he frequently fell asleep even during the most important state functions. His lovely young queen, Porin, did as much as she possibly could to relieve the burdens imposed upon him by his crown, but it was quite obvious to all who knew him that King Rhodar would be unable to reign much longer. At last, toward the end of a severe winter that had locked the north in snow and ice deeper than anyone could remember, Queen Porin sent a messenger to the Vale to entreat Polgara to come to Boktor to try to use her healing arts on the Drasnian king. The messenger arrived late one bitter afternoon as the wan sun sank almost wearily into a bed of purple cloud lying heavily over the mountains of Ulgo. He was thickly wrapped in rich sable fur, but his long, pointed nose protruded from the warm interior of his deep cowl, and immediately identified him.
"Silk!"
Dernick exclaimed, as the little Drasnian dismounted in the snowy dooryard. What are you doing all the way down here?
Freezing, actually, Silk replied. I hope you have got a good fire going.
Paul, look who's here, Dernick called, and Polgara opened the door to look out at their visitor.
Well, Prince Keldar, she said, smiling at the rat-faced little man. Have you so completely plundered Garognadrak that you have come in search of a new theater for your depredations?
No, Silk told her, stamping his half-frozen feet on the ground. I made the mistake of passing through Bokdor on my way to Val-Alorn. Porin dragooned me into making a side trip.
Go inside, Dernick told him. I'll tend to your horse.
After Silk had removed his sable cloak, he stood shivering in front of the arched fireplace, with his hands extended toward the flames.
I've been cold for the last week, he grumbled. Where is Belgarath?
He and Belden are off in the east somewhere, Polgara replied, mixing the half-frozen man a cup of spiced wine to help warm him.
It's no matter, I suppose. Actually, I came to see you. You have heard that my uncle is not well?
She nodded, picking up a glowing hot poker and plunging it into the wine with a bubbling hiss.
Etar brought us some news about that last fall. Have his physicians put a name to his illness yet?
Old age, Silk shrugged, gratefully taking the cup from her. Rodar isn't really that old. But he's carrying a lot of extra weight. It tires a man out after a while. Porin is desperate. She sent me to ask you, no, to beg you, to come to Bokdor and see what you can do. She says to tell you that Rodar won't see the geese come north if you don't come. Is it really that bad?
Oh, I'm not a physician, Silk replied. But he doesn't look very good, and his mind seems to be slipping. He's even starting to lose his appetite, and that is a bad sign in a man who always ate 7 big meals a day.
Well, then of course we'll come, Polgara said quickly. Oh, but just let me get warm first, Silk said in a plaintive tone.
They were delayed for several days just south of Alderford by a savage blizzard that swept out of the mountains of Sindaria to howl across the open plains of northern Algeria. As luck had it, they reached the encampment of a nomadic band of roving herdsmen just as the storm broke, and sat out the days of shrieking wind and driving snow in the comfortable wagons of the hospitable Algars. When the weather cleared at last, they pressed on toward Alderford, crossed the river, and reached the broad causeway that stretched across the snow-choked fens to Bokdor. Queen Porin, still lovely, despite the dark circles under her eyes that spoke so eloquently of her sleepless concern, greeted them at the gates of King Rodar's palace.
"Oh, Polgara,"
she said, overwhelmed with gratitude and relief as she embraced the sorceress.
"Dear Porin," Polgara said, enfolding the careworn little Drasnian queen in her arms. "We'd have been here sooner, but we encountered bad weather. How is Rodar?"
"A little weaker every day,"
Porin replied, with a kind of hopelessness in her voice. "Even Kaeva tires him now."
"Your son?"
Porin nodded.
"The next king of Drasnia. He's only 6, much too young to ascend the throne."
"Well, let's see what we can do to delay that."
King Rodar, however, looked even worse than Silk's assessment of his condition had led them to believe. Erend remembered the king of Drasnia as a fat, jolly man with a quick wit and seemingly inexhaustible supply of energy. Now he was listless, and his gray-hued skin hung on him in folds. He could not rise. Perhaps even more serious was the fact that he could not lie down without his breath coming in painful, choking gasps. His voice, which had once been powerful enough to wake a sleeping army, had become a puny, querulous wheeze. He smiled a tired little smile of greeting when they entered, but after only a few minutes of conversation, he dozed off again.
"I think I need to be alone with him," Polgara told the rest of them in a crisp, efficient voice.
But the quick look she exchanged with Silk carried little hope for the ailing monarch's recovery.
When she emerged from Rodar's room, her expression was grave.
Well?
Poran asked, her eyes fearful.
I will speak frankly. We've known each other too long for me to hide the truth from you. I can make his breathing a bit easier and relieve some of his discomfort. There are some things that will make him more alert for short periods of time, but we have to use those sparingly, probably only when there are some major decisions to be made.
But you cannot cure him.
Poran's quiet voice hovered on the very edge of tears.
It is not a condition that is subject to cure, Poran. His body is just worn out. I have told him for years that he was eating himself to death. He's as heavy as three normal men. A man's heart was simply not designed to carry that kind of weight. He has not had any real exercise in the past several years, and his diet is absolutely the worst he could possibly have come up with.
Could you use sorcery?
The Dresdian queen asked desperately.
Poran, I would have to rebuild him from the ground up. Nothing he has really functions right anymore. Sorcery simply would not work. I'm sorry.
Two great tears welled up in Queen Poran's eyes.
How long?
She asked, in a voice scarcely more than a whisper.
A few months, six at the most.
Poran nodded, and then, despite her tear-filled eyes, she lifted her chin bravely.
When you think he is strong enough, I would like to have you give him those potions that will clear his mind. He and I will have to talk. There are arrangements that are going to have to be made, for the sake of our son, and for Dresnia.
Of course, Poran.
The bitter cold of that long, cruel winter broke quite suddenly a couple of days later. A warm wind blew in off of the Gulf of Kerik during the night, bringing with it a gusty rainstorm that turned the drifts clogging the broad avenues of Boktor into sodden brown slush. Erend and Prince Keva, the heir to the Dresnian throne, found themselves confined to the palace by the sudden change of weather. Crown Prince Keva was a sturdy little boy with dark hair and a serious expression. Like his father, the ailing King Rodar, Keva had a marked preference for the color red, and he customarily wore a velvet doublet and hose in that hue. Though Erend was perhaps 5 years or so older than the prince, the two of them became friends almost immediately. Together they discovered the enormous entertainment to be found in rolling a brightly colored wooden ball down a long flight of stone stairs. After the bouncing ball knocked a silver tray from the hands of the chief butler, however, they were asked, quite firmly, to find other amusements. They wandered for a time through the echoing marble halls of the palace, Keva in his bright red velvet and Erend in his sturdy peasant brown, until they came at last to the grand ballroom. At one end of the enormous hall, a broad marble staircase with a crimson carpet down the center descended from the upper floors of the palace, and along each side of that imposing stair was a smooth marble balustrade. The two boys looked speculatively at those twin banisters, both of them immediately recognizing the tremendous potential of all of that slippery marble. There were polished chairs along each side of the ballroom, and each chair was padded with a red velvet cushion. The boys looked at the balustrades, then they looked at the cushions, then they both turned to be sure that no guard or palace functionary was in the vicinity of the large double doors at the back of the ballroom. Erend prudently closed the doors, then he and Prince Keva went to work. There were many chairs and many red velvet cushions. When those cushions were all piled in two heaps at the bottom of the marble stair railings, they made a pair of quite imposing mountains.
Well,
Keva said, when all was in readiness.
I guess we might as well,
Erend replied. Together they climbed the stairs, and then each of them mounted one of the smooth, cool banisters, descending grandly toward the white marble floor of the ballroom far below.
Go!
Keva shouted, and the two of them slid down, gaining tremendous speed as they went and landing with soft thumps in the heaps of cushions waiting them below. Laughing with delight, the two boys ran back up the stairs again, and once again they slid down. All in all, the afternoon went very well, until at last one of the cushions burst its seams and filled the quiet air of the grand ballroom with softly drifting goose down. It was, quite naturally, at that precise moment that Polgara came looking for them. Somehow it always happened that way. The moment anything was broken, spilled, or tipped over, someone in authority would appear. There was never an opportunity to tidy up, and so such situations always presented themselves in the worst possible light. The double doors at the far end of the ballroom opened, and Polgara, regally beautiful in blue velvet, stepped inside. Her face was grave as she regarded the guilty-looking pair lying at the foot of the stairs in their piles of cushions, with a positive blizzard of goose down swirling around them. Erend winced and held his breath. Very softly she closed the doors behind her and walked slowly toward them, her heels sounding ominously loud on the marble floor. She looked at the denuded chairs lining each side of the ballroom. She looked at the marble balustrades. She looked at the boys with feathers settling on them. And then, without warning whatsoever, she began to laugh, a rich, warm, vibrant laugh that absolutely filled the empty hall. Erend felt somehow betrayed by her reaction. He and Kiva had gone out of their way to get themselves into trouble, and all she did was laugh about it. There was no scolding, no acid commentary, nothing but laughter. He definitely felt that this levity was out of place, an indication that she was not taking this thing as seriously as she ought. He felt a trifle bitter about the whole thing. He had earned the scolding she was denying them.
"You boys will clean it up, won't you?" she asked them.
"Of course, Lady Polgara,"
Kiva assured her quickly.
"We were just about to do that."
"Splendid, Your Highness," she said, the corners of her mouth still twitching. "Do try to gather up all the feathers." And she turned and walked out of the ballroom, leaving the faint echo of her laughter hovering in the air behind her. After that, the boys were watched rather closely. There was nothing really obvious about it. It was just that there always seemed to be someone around to call a halt before things got completely out of hand. About a week later, when the rains had passed and the slush had mostly melted off of the streets, Erend and Kiva were sitting on the floor of a carpeted room building a fortress out of wooden blocks. At a table near the window, Silk, splendidly dressed in rich black velvet, was carefully reading a dispatch he had received that morning from his partner, Yarblek, who had remained in Garagnadrak to tend the business. About mid-morning, a servant came into the room and spoke briefly with the rat-faced little man. Silk nodded, rose, and came over to where the boys were playing.
"What would you gentlemen say to a breath of fresh air?"
"Of course,"
Erend replied, getting to his feet.
"And you, cousin?" Silk asked Kiva.
"Certainly, Your Highness," Kiva said.
Silk laughed. "Must we be so formal, Kiva?"
"Mother says I should always use the proper forms of address,"
Kiva told him seriously.
"I guess it's to help me keep in practice or something."
"Your mother isn't here," Silk told him slyly, "so it's all right to cheat a little."
Kiva looked around nervously.
"Do you really think we should?"
he whispered.
"Oh, I'm sure of it," Silk replied. "Cheating is good for you. It helps you to keep your perspective."
"Do you cheat often?"
"Me?"
Silk was still laughing.
"All the time, cousin. All of the time. Let us fetch some cloaks and take a turn about the city. I have to go by the headquarters of the Intelligence Service, and since I've been appointed your keeper for the day, the two of you had better come along."
The air outside was cool and damp, and the wind was brisk enough to whip their cloaks about their legs as they passed along the cobbled streets of Bokhtor. The Drasnian capital was one of the major commercial centers of the world, and the streets teemed with men of all races. Richly mantled Tonedrans spoke on street corners with sober-faced Sindars in sensible brown. Flamboyantly garbed and richly jeweled Drasnians haggled with leather-garbed Nadraks, and there were even a few black-robed Murgos striding along the blustery streets with their broad-backed Tullish porters trailing behind them, carrying heavy packs filled with merchandise. The porters, of course, were followed at a discreet distance by the ever-present spies. "Dear sneaky old Bokhtar," Silk declaimed extravagantly, "where at least every other man you meet is a spy."
"Are those men spies?"
Kiva asked, looking at them with a surprised expression. "Of course they are, Your Highness," Silk laughed again. "Everybody in Thrasnia is a spy, or wants to be. It is our national industry. Didn't you know that?"
"Well, I knew that there are quite a few spies in the palace, but I didn't think they'd be out in the streets."
"Why should there be spies in the palace?"
Erend asked him curiously. Kiva shrugged. "Everybody wants to know what everybody else is doing. The more important you are, the more spies you have watching you."
"Are any of them watching you?"
"Oh, six that I know of. There are probably a few more besides. And of course, all the spies are being spied on by other spies."
"What a peculiar place,"
Erend murmured.
Kiva laughed.
"Once, when I was about 3 or so, I found a hiding place under a stair and fell asleep. Eventually, all the spies in the palace joined in the search for me. You would be amazed at how many there really are."
This time, Silk laughed uproariously. "Oh, that's really very bad form, cousin. Members of the royal family are not supposed to hide from the spies. It upsets them terribly. That's the building over there." He pointed at a large stone warehouse standing on a quiet side street.
"I always thought that the headquarters was in the same building with the academy,"
Kiva said. "Those are the official offices, cousin. This is the place where the work gets done." They entered the warehouse and went through a cavernous room piled high with boxes and bales to a small, unobtrusive door with a bulky-looking man in a workman's smock lounging against it. The man gave Silk a quick look, bowed, and opened the door for them. Beyond that somewhat shabby-looking door lay a large, well-lighted room with a dozen or more parchment-littered tables standing along the walls. At each table sat 4 or 5 people, all poring over the documents before them.
"What are they doing?"
Erend asked curiously. "Assorting information," Silk replied. "There probably isn't much that happens in the world that doesn't reach this room eventually. If we really wanted to know, we could probably ask around and find out what the King of Arendia had for breakfast this morning. We want to go into that room over there." He pointed toward a solid-looking door on the far side of the room. The chamber beyond the door was plain, even bare. It contained a table and 4 chairs, nothing more. The man seated at the table in one of the chairs wore black hose and a pearl-gray doublet. He was as thin as an old bone, and even here, in the very midst of his own people, there was about him the sense of a tightly coiled spring. "Silk," he said with a terse nod. "Javelin," Silk replied. "You wanted to see me." The man at the table looked at the 2 boys. He inclined his head briefly to Kiva. "Your Highness," he said.
"Margrave Kenden,"
the prince responded with a polite bow. The seated man looked at Silk, his idle-appearing fingers twitching slightly.
"Margrave,"
Kiva said almost apologetically,
"my mother's been teaching me the secret language. I know what you're saying."
The man Silk called Javelin stopped moving his fingers with a rueful expression. "Caught by my own cleverness." He looked speculatively at Erend. "This is Erend. The boy Polgara and Dernick are raising," Silk told him. "Ah," Javelin said, "the bearer of the orb."
"Kiva and I can wait outside if you want to speak privately," Erend offered.
Javelin thought about that.
"That probably won't be necessary. I think we can trust you both to be discreet. Sit down, gentlemen."
He pointed at the other 3 chairs.
"I'm sort of retired, Javelin. I've got enough other things to keep me busy just now," Silk told him. "I wasn't really going to ask you to get personally involved," Javelin replied. All I really want is for you to find room for a couple of new employees in one of your enterprises.
Silk gave him a curious look.
You're shipping goods out of Gorognadrak along the northern caravan route,
Javelin continued.
There are several villages near the border where the citizens are highly suspicious of strangers with no valid reason for passing through.
Oh, and you want to use my caravans to give your men an excuse for being in those villages? Javelin shrugged.
It is not an uncommon practice.
What's going on in Eastern Drasnia that you're so interested in?
The same thing that has always been going on in the outlying districts.
The bear cult? Silk asked incredulously. You are going to waste time on them?
They have been behaving peculiarly lately. I want to find out why.
Silk looked at him with one eyebrow raised.
Just call it idle curiosity, if you like.
The look Silk gave him then was very hard.
Oh, no. You're not going to catch me that easily, my friend. Aren't you the least bit curious?
No. As a matter of fact, I'm not. No amount of clever trickery is going to lure me into neglecting my own affairs to go off on another one of your fishing expeditions. I'm too busy, Javelin. His eyes narrowed ever so slightly. Why don't you send Hunter?
Hunter is busy someplace else, Silk. And stop trying to find out who Hunter is.
It was worth a try. Actually, I'm not interested at all, not in the least.
He sat back in his chair with his arms adamantly crossed. His long pointed nose, however, was twitching.
What do you mean by behaving peculiarly?
He asked after a moment.
I thought you weren't interested.
I'm not, Silk repeated hastily.
I most definitely am not.
His nose, however, was twitching even more violently. Angrily, he got to his feet.
Give me the names of the men you want me to hire. I'll see what I can do. Of course, Prince Geldar,
Javelin said.
I appreciate your sense of loyalty to your old service.
Erend remembered something that Silk had said in the large outer room.
Silk says that information about almost everything is brought to this building, he said to Javelin.
That might be an exaggeration, but we try.
Then perhaps you might have heard something about Zandramas?
Javelin looked at him blankly.
It's something that Belgarian and I heard about,
Erend explained.
And Belgrath's curious about it, too. I thought you might have heard about it.
I cannot say that I have,
Javelin admitted.
Of course, we are a long way from Darshiva.
What's Darshiva?
It is one of the principalities of the old Nasini Empire in eastern Meloria. Zandrama is a Darshivan name. Didn't you know that?
No, we didn't.
There was a light tap at the door.
Yes, Javelin answered.
The door opened and a young lady of perhaps 19 or 20 came in. Her hair was the color of honey. Her eyes were a warm golden brown, and she wore a plain-looking gray dress. Her expression was serious, but there was just the hint of a dimple in each of her cheeks.
Uncle, she said,
and her voice had a kind of vibrancy about it that made it almost irresistibly compelling. Javelin's hard, angular face softened noticeably.
Yes, Lyselle. Is this little Lyselle?
Silk exclaimed.
Not quite so little anymore, Javelin said. The last time I saw her, she was still in braids. She combed out the braids a few years ago,
Javelin said dryly.
And look what was hiding under them.
Oh, I am looking, Silk said admiringly.
The report you wanted, Uncle,
the girl said, laying a sheaf of parchment on the table. Then she turned to Kiva and curtsied to him with incredible grace.
Your Highness,
she greeted him.
My great Dane Lysel,
the little prince replied with a polite bow.
And Prince Skeldar,
the girl said.
Oh, we weren't at all so formal
when you were a child,
Silk protested.
But then, I am not a child anymore, Your Highness.
Silk looked over at Javelin.
When she was a little girl, she used to pull my nose.
But it is such a long, interesting nose,
Lysel said. Then she smiled, and the dimples suddenly sprang to life.
Lysel is helping out here. She will be entering the academy in a few months.
You are going to be a spy?
Silk asked her incredulously.
It is the family business, Prince Geldar. My father and mother were both spies. My uncle here is a spy. All of my friends are spies. How could I possibly be anything else?
Silk looked a trifle off balance.
It just doesn't seem appropriate for some reason.
That probably means that I'll be quite successful, doesn't it? You look like a spy, Prince Geldar. I don't, so I won't have nearly as many problems as you have had.
Though the girl's answers were very clever, even pert, Erend could see something in her warm brown eyes that Silk probably missed. Despite the fact that the Margravine Lysel was obviously a grown woman, Silk just as obviously still thought of her as a little girl, one who had pulled his nose. The look she gave him, however, was not the look of a little girl. And Erend realized that she had been waiting for a number of years for the opportunity to meet Silk on adult terms. Erend covered his mouth with his hand to hide a smile. The wily Prince Keldar had some very interesting times ahead of him. The door opened again, and a nondescript man came in, quickly crossed to the table, and whispered something to Javelin. The man's face, Erend noticed, was pale, and his hands were trembling. Javelin's face grew set, and then he sighed. He gave no other outward sign of emotion, however. He rose to his feet and came around the table.
"Your Majesty,"
he said formally to Prince Kiva,
"I believe that you should return to the palace immediately."
Silk and Lysel both caught the changed form of address and looked sharply at the Chief of Drasnian Intelligence.
"I believe that we should all accompany the king back to the palace,"
Javelin said sadly.
"We must offer our condolences to his mother and aid her in any way we can in her hour of grief."
The King of Drasnia looked at his intelligence chief, his eyes very wide and his lip trembling. Erend gently took the little boy's hand in his.
"We'd better go, Kiva," he said. "Your mother will need you very much right now."